First case is 06507, Alice Peters, Administrator versus Columbus Steel Castings. Mr. Millizer.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Richard Millizer. I represent Columbus Steel Castings, a steel forger company. At issue and at stake in this appeal is the ability to enforce pre-dispute arbitration agreements in the wrongful death context as to wrongful death claims in Ohio. In addressing this issue and the interplay between Ohio's wrongful death and Ohio's Arbitration Act, the Court of Appeals erred in three ways. One, it failed to recognize the relevant and unique nature of wrongful death claims and instead selectively applied this court's jurisprudence from the law of judgments. Two, it equated the law of arbitration and the effect of arbitration agreements with the law of judgments and the effect of judgments, and specifically this court's prohibition against the release of claims not yet in existence. And third, it erred in distinguishing decisions by state Supreme Courts in other jurisdictions. State Supreme Courts that have applied pre-dispute arbitration agreements to wrongful death claims, even in states that recognize that wrongful death claims are independent for other purposes, including states that recognize that damages are not the property of the estate, but damages and thus are not subject to the claim of creditors, but are the property of the statutory beneficiaries. Before discussing those errors, let me address the impact of the Court of Appeals decision if it would be affirmed. Although wrongful death claims are not excluded from coverage under 2711, Ohio's Arbitration Act, that would be the practical effect of the Court of Appeals decision. It's not clear whether my opponent's position is that it's the personal representative or the statutory beneficiaries who are required to sign the pre-dispute arbitration agreement. If it was the statutory beneficiaries, and I think that is their position, many of those statutory beneficiaries may not have been born at the time the pre-dispute arbitration agreement is entered into in the employment context.
Is there any claim for recovery by the estate?
Yes, there was a survivorship claim as well.
I thought the position advanced by your opponents was that this was a survivorship claim, and there wasn't any claim made for the estate.
Now, there was two claims asserted in the complaint. One was a survivorship claim on behalf of the estate, and the second was the wrongful death claim asserted for damages to the statutory beneficiaries. The trial court made it clear it was going to, apply the pre-dispute arbitration agreement as to the survivorship claim, subject to additional hearing on three issues. Before that hearing was held, the survivorship claim was dismissed, perfecting this appeal.
All right.
Counsel, I'm particularly interested in opposing counsel's assertion that there has to be a signatory to this agreement for arbitration in order for it to be effective and bind surviving spouses and statutory beneficiaries. When in the real world would a spouse or children ever sign an employment contract or a contract for employment that waives statutory remedies and goes to an arbitration agreement?
I don't think it's ever going to happen in the real world, Your Honor. Person might, even if you could get spouses to sign it, a person could get divorced and remarried. Also, the statutory wrongful death claims must be asserted on behalf of next of kin. And in this case, that was exactly done in the complaint, references the next of kin. If the personal representative can't even determine who was party to the wrongful death claim after the death, how is an employer I'm going to have that knowledge at the commencement of the employment relationship. The other problem, or the other impact or effect of not enforcing the wrongful death claim as to pre-dispute arbitration agreements, you will have two cases, the survivorship claim being tried in court and the wrongful death claim being tried in a separate forum in arbitration. They both share the same facts, underlying facts. They both share the same legal elements of liability. The same issues will be addressed in discovery. And so you will have either two cases going simultaneously and maybe conflicting judgments, or more likely what you will have is an effort to stay one of the two cases. But, you know, which court or which case is stayed, the arbitration case or the court case? Both parties will certainly be moving for stays.
But that result is militated by virtue of the fact of the arbitration agreement, isn't it?
It's our position that the arbitration agreement covers all claims arising in the workplace, and by the very nature of a wrongful death claim and how it interplays with the Arbitration Act, it's our position that the personal representative and the statutory beneficiaries, or the personal representative who asserts the claim, is a party by law to that arbitration agreement.
Would we have to, that sounds like new law to me, would we have to write something new to get where you want us to get to be?
Your Honor, this issue has not been addressed in Ohio. My opponent is relying on authority from the law of judgments, a line of cases that this court has recognized that they are independent claims, and they are independent claims so long as the statutory beneficiaries have an equitable right to damages. But that is a different context than this context, and this issue has not been decided by this court. It has been decided by other state Supreme Courts who have not required contractual privity. We think, by analogy, the court's jurisprudence in the Holt decision applying the uninsured motorist coverage is in context, because what it recognized in Holt is that truly wrongful death claims are a special breed. It's a different animal. It's different because the personal representative is pursuing the wrongful death of the decedent. And in that context, they are, in fact, stepping into the shoes
but in Holt,
of the
aren't
decedent.
The, aren't the beneficiaries insured under the policy? Weren't they insured under the policy? So there's a closer connection, not a legal term.
The statutory beneficiaries actually were not insured under the policy in Holt, and that was the issue the court faced.
Yeah.
And it didn't focus just on insurance law. It looked at what was the nature of wrongful death claims to reach that result.
The other legal principle we have here is, of course, that if one is to be subjected to arbitration as a process for a remedy, that they must be a signatory to the contract. They must have agreed to it. Here, I guess your same argument is that they stand in the shoes of the person who did agree to be bound.
That's right, Your Honor.
If it's an independent cause of action, that the beneficiaries of an independent cause of action, and they obviously did not sign the contract to be bound to arbitration. Two legal principles that we have to sort of to which we have to make exceptions here. How should we do that? Use the jurisprudence of other states that have.
I think you can use the jurisprudence from other states who have looked at this issue, even in states like Ohio that recognize that wrongful death claims are independent claims for certain purposes, but also look at the jurisprudence of this state and how this court has struggled with the interplay between the wrongful death statutes and other statutes in Ohio. I think it's wrong to assert, just because this court has held in the law of judgment context, that a wrongful death claim cannot be barred by the actions of a decedent in a judgment for or against the decedent in a prior case. That should apply. That was true in that case, but when Thompson v. Wing is the seminal case on that issue, they were addressing the language of if death had not ensued. Does that mean that does that mean that the action still existed at the time of the decedent's death, or at some earlier time? And the court held it means not at the time of the decedent's death, because the decedent didn't have a claim at that time, but at some earlier time. In the arbitration context, the decedent always was subject to arbitration. So Thompson just is not applicable to this context. So yes, you will have to fashion a new rule, but it's perfectly consistent with this court's jurisprudence of wrongful death claims in Ohio. The other thing to point out, I'm sorry.
Counsel, the first bridge to be crossed here is determining whether these heirs and the representatives of the decedent are bound by the arbitration agreement. And if that's the case, we don't have to worry about any of the other issues that have been presented here. Would you agree with that?
The sole issue before the court is that.
And in looking at the language and how the appellate court has treated it, on page 8, the appellate court simply states that an arbitration is a matter of agreement, a contract that purports to bind a party to arbitrate, but lacks the party's signature, is generally not a sufficient basis on which to compel arbitration. Consequently, the mere naming of William Peters' heirs and beneficiaries as parties to the plan without their agreement does not require the heirs and beneficiaries to arbitrate, but there's no cite to any authority for this. This is the appellate court. Is that the appellate court making new law there?
I think they are making new law to the extent they're ignoring the nature of wrongful death claims. Of course, we acknowledge that the first principle of arbitration, there has to be an agreement to arbitrate. But there is an agreement to arbitrate here. All the claims arising in the workplace at CSC, the parties agreed to arbitrate those claims. And now we have in the wrongful this unique nature of a wrongful death claim where the personal representative steps into the shoes of the decedent. Well, they're stepping into his shoes to pursue the wrongful death claim. They ought to also step into his shoes to pursue the arbitration agreement, which was intended to cover those claims.
And as far as I read the information that we've received here, there's nothing that would preclude a wrongful death from having been envisioned with the arbitration agreement.
That's
and
right.
There's no exclusion,
That's
there's
correct.
No deletion, there's nothing to say this is effective but for these types of actions.
That's correct, Your Honor. May I reserve the remaining my remaining time?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Millizer. Mr. Rourke.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I am John Vail, who will argue on behalf of the plaintiffs in the case, and I thank you for your leave to appear before you today.
Did Michael Rourke sign in as the attorney?
No, John Vail did.
I don't even have John Vail listed as an attorney in the case on her, but go ahead, we'll let you argue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me make 3 points, and then I'll address some
before,
of the-
Before you get to your 3 points, I'd like to ask a question about the policy questions here about why arbitration is not a choice of the plaintiff here. What's the problem with going to an arbitration here?
Well, whatever the problem, I can go to the practical problems. One of the practical problems is, in this complex, factually intensive wrongful death case, under the arbitration agreement here, the plaintiffs would have the opportunity to do one deposition by right in court. They have broader choices for discovery, and in a factually intensive case, that matters, as this one. So that's just explaining the plaintiff's choice. The other is the legislature has vested the plaintiffs with the choice of forum. No question here that the plaintiffs could sue where they wanted to. If there were diversity in this case, they could bring the case in federal court. Choice of forum is an aspect of control of the property interest in the cause of action that is vested in the plaintiffs. They have the right to make that choice. CSC says that it should be taken away. The first question, to go to your question, the first question in any arbitration case is the question of, does a contract exist? And we reach that at page 10 of our merit brief, the authority for that. That's the statute itself. The statute grants a jury trial in the otherwise summary proceedings. The plaintiffs have a right to a jury trial on the question of whether a contract exists. The defendant has not advanced any theory of contract law which would bind the plaintiffs to the arbitration agreement here. They are not signatories, but beyond that, in arbitration law in general, there are generally two theories recognized: third-party beneficiary and agency. There is clearly no agency vested in the decedent to control the plaintiff's cause of action. In fact, the legislature purposefully insulated the plaintiffs from actions the decedent might take. That's an aspect of the claim being independent. If the decedent had written a will that said, I say that any plaintiff's claim for my wrongful death must be arbitrated, it would have no effect. No effect whatsoever. He has no power to affect that decision. Importantly, the plaintiffs are insulated from the decedent's creditors. If the decedent is a spendthrift, the proceeds of this claim go to the decedent's. Now, the law here...
Proceeds of the claim?
Go to the beneficiaries. Okay. Excuse me. The law related to this claim is very old. There were claims, and this court has wrestled with the question of, did a claim for wrongful death exist at common law? One of the claims that was clearly recognized at common law was a claim between master and servant. When a servant was damaged, if a servant was killed and a master was entitled to services of the servant, the master had a recognized cause of action independent of any claim the servant might have had for damages caused by that lack of service. There's a certain analog in this to that and in the independent claim. And 100 years ago, when the court in Mahoning looked at the wrongful death statute for the first time, not the first time, actually, it was the third time, as it noted, the court at that time recognized the different kinds of actions. It recognized this split between derivative actions and independent actions. It looked at the legislative history, it looked at what it had done, and it chose a position. This court and the legislature have meticulously cleaved to that position in the intervening years. And again, there's no third-party beneficiary assertion here, and it would be the beneficiaries asserting the benefit. But you can look at that in the Parsley case, the case from the Southern District that's cited here. That's a third-party beneficiary case. That's a case in which the statutory beneficiary was also a third-party beneficiary of the extermination contract that was at issue. And she was found bound to the arbitration agreement in that contract, independent of, not because of, and perhaps in spite of, her status as a statutory beneficiary. But she was, in fact, a third-party beneficiary of the contract.
But we don't have any claim of third-party beneficiary in
no,
this instance.
That's my point.
That's just nice to know about. But the fact is here, I think Mr. Milzer is saying what you're really doing is splitting a cause of action. And he suggests that because you stand in the shoes of the decedent, it ought to be in one proceeding. And since the decedent has chosen that there will be no court proceeding, you are denied the opportunity to go to court. And I guess your position would be under 212502, the legislature has given the survivors their own claim, and you sort of would like to split this cause of action, I guess.
That's correct, and as you observed, Your Honor, that is a consequence of the choice in arbitration law to enforce arbitration agreements. We've addressed that in our brief, the Dean Witter Reynolds case, and let me quote you from what's the granddaddy case in this is the Moses H. Cohn Hospital case at the Supreme Court, which is interpreting the Federal Arbitration Act, but this court has recognized that the Ohio statute is construed closely with the FAA. This is from Moses H. Cohn, and I point you to footnote 6, pages 23, 24 in our merit brief. The hospital points out that it has two substantive disputes here, one with Mercury concerning Mercury's claim, etc. The latter dispute cannot be sent to arbitration without the architect's consent, since there is no arbitration agreement between the hospital and the architect. It is true, therefore, that if Mercury obtains an arbitration order for its dispute, the hospital will be forced to resolve these related disputes in different forums. That misfortune, however, is not the result of any choice between the federal and state courts. It occurs because the relevant law requires piecemeal resolution when necessary to give effect to an arbitration agreement.
So, counsel, when this arbitration agreement talks about all claims arising from the workplace, you would have us say that means claims excluding wrongful death.
No, I say it's language that clearly covers all claims, but it does not cover these parties. These parties, the plaintiffs here, are strangers to that agreement.
So you would have us say that every individual that would bring a claim under a wrongful death action would have had to sign the agreement.
Or somehow otherwise be bound by contract. Yes, but that's not...
How would they be bound by contract if they didn't sign the...
I don't know. I'm just not excluding the possibility. I think effectively it's signing.
Well, let me ask you the same question I ask opposing counsel. In the real world, when does a spouse come in and sign an employment contract that her husband has, or a husband that a wife's employed, whatever, or the children? When do they come in and sign an agreement to arbitrate?
Well, they could do that now. They could do it today. This case could be arbitrated tomorrow if the plaintiffs chose the arbitral forum. It simply
Counselor, that's not my question. At the inception of the employment contract, in the real world, do spouses, next of kin, come in and sign the same document that the employee signs to agree to arbitration?
Well, obviously not, Your Honor. No. And I think but just like the proponent of any other contract and any other contractual relationship, if the employer wants to make that contractual arrangement, that's what the employer has to do. That's what freedom of contract is about. Private parties meeting together, finding a meeting of the minds, and agreeing. No agreement has been made in this case. And there's not even a theory here by which you can find agreement.
So does that mean that if we would agree with your position that all consortium claims arising out of any other type of injury could be litigated in court and the arbitration agreement wouldn't cover them because the individual who would have the claim for consortium didn't sign the arbitration agreement, even though it arose out of the workplace, as Justice Lanzinger pointed out?
I expect that in the real world that is correct, Your Honor. But remember that the constitutional default, is that any plaintiff has a right of access to courts and a right to trial by jury when they go to court on an appropriate claim. That's the default position. Arbitration is the outlier. The statutes by which we have created the right to enforce arbitration agreements, and I want to emphasize that the policy embodied in these statutes is really rightly said to be a policy to enforce arbitration agreements. It's not really a policy in favor of arbitration. It's a policy that says when people voluntarily agree to arbitrate, we will provide the equitable remedy of specific enforcement to that contractual claim. And that is the genesis of the Federal Arbitration Act, as pointed out in the Cohn article that we've cited in our briefing, and the Ohio Act. Arbitration is the outlier. That's the Moses Cohn case clearly saying that. It trumps even our policies about judicial economy and splitting causes of action, because we've made a legislative decision to enforce freely made agreements. Here, the first question is there a contract to arbitrate? Here, we simply don't have it. And any proponent of any contract bears a burden of proof and persuasion that the contract exists.
Counsel, I want to take you outside of anything that you've raised in this case, and that is, and perhaps we have cases that I'm just unaware of that say this is okay, but I'm having difficulty with the concept of arbitration being available at all in an intentional tort case. An intentional tort by an employer is so far outside of what an employer is expected to do that this court has said constitutionally the employer doesn't get the protection of the workers' compensation, the constitutionally created workers' compensation system. My question is why, as a matter of public policy, I mean, it's very near to a crime, an intentional tort by an employer. Why, as a matter of public policy, should an employer ever be able, death or not, to impose arbitration to take away the fundamental constitutional rights of the employee in the case of an intentional tort, period?
Well, Your Honor, I certainly would agree with you about that as a matter of public policy.
It's a question.
Because, right. But and I said, the question is, I would agree with you. I think public policy would support that. Whether the Federal Arbitration Act permits that, the Federal Arbitration Act permits generalized doctrines of not, if you don't support.
Have we ever addressed that question that you know of?
Not that I know of, Your Honor.
All right.
With that, my time is up, and listen
thank
for you, the
Mr.
questions.
Bale,
thank
you, Mr. Bale. I owe you an apology. The clerk that checked in the lawyers indicates that she indicated to me the wrong name of the lawyer that checked in, so thank you.
No problem. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Millager, you've saved a little more than 20 minutes. 2 minutes.
I wish it was 20
minutes. Mr. Bale will get to 20 minutes after you talk. A little more than 2 minutes.
Let me make just two points. And to your point earlier, Chief Justice Moyer, this court is going to have to struggle with how these statutes should interplay because it's not been addressed in Ohio. So it is going to require you to make new law in that context. All of the law that's being relied on by my opponent is from the law of judgments. And all the law of judgments says, and all this court has said with respect to the law of judgments, is that a decedent cannot bar or release claims that are not yet in existence. Well, arbitration, by its nature, applies to claims that are not yet in existence. Yet, the General Assembly and this court, as well as the Supreme Court of the United States, have held, notwithstanding that, pre-dispute arbitration agreements are favored as a matter of policy.
Counsel, how do you address what I think is the strongest argument, being that plaintiffs with a cause of action have the right to choose their own forum, and the idea that You know, we are talking about a separate cause of action here with a wrongful death.
The forum was chosen at the outset of the employment relationship when the parties agreed to submit all claims arising out of the workplace at CSC, specifically including intentional tort claims, to the arbitration forum. They are now, the personal representative is now stepping into the shoes of the decedent to pursue those claims. It's the decedent's wrongful death claim. This would be an independent claim, a wholly independent claim, if the statutory beneficiaries were injured by CSC outside of the workplace, such as a defective product or product liability case. That's not what we have. We have the workplace death of the decedent, William Peters, and they're stepping into his shoes to pursue his claim.
So it's a question of whose claim it is. Your view is that it's the decedent's, and it comes within that phrase arising out of the workplace. That's your strongest argument.
That's essentially correct. It's actually the damages are the statutory beneficiary's damages, but the underlying claim is clearly the decedent's claim. Just like in Holt, where the insurance proceeds were equated as damages of the statutory beneficiaries, but still this court recognized that the personal representative stepped into the shoes of the decedent and therefore found, based on that analysis, found that the personal representatives were covered insureds, even though they were excluded or not excluded from coverage or not included within the definition of insured within the policy.
So you would like us to focus on whose claim it is, basically?
Yes. I think that's a good way of saying it.
You don't deny, though, that the statute permits independent recovery for...
No, absolutely not. He has the independent recovery of their statutory beneficiary damages, but that doesn't change the unique nature of a wrongful death claim.
Is that... So it's one action, and this is splitting a cause of action.
That's right.
Basically, your position.
That's right.
I want to still press you on that, because it seems to me that the claim on behalf of the estate is pain and suffering and so forth, that's that's clearly the decedent's claim. But here, the beneficiaries are entitled to damages based upon the fact that they've lost the decedent. Decedent died, and they have damages from that, obviously. That seems more like their claim to me than the estate's claim for damages, obviously, on behalf of the decedent.
You've touched on the unique nature of a wrongful death claim, because the damages are the statutory beneficiaries, the damages to the statutory beneficiaries.
Which means it's an independent claim, which still having trouble understanding why the holders of that claim do not have the right to choose the nature of the action to receive their damages.
I think that's
Holt is Holt your strongest case, though it's somewhat Appleby's, of course, try to distinguish it.
It's because of the unique nature of a wrongful death claim. It is different from a products liability claim, where the statutory beneficiaries would be injured directly by CSC. Their claim arises because of the wrongful death, not to the statutory beneficiary, but to William Peters. Otherwise, that claim would not exist. And so the court has to recognize the unique nature, the special nature of wrongful death claims, as it has done in other contexts. I want to make one more point.
Very quickly.
Collateral estoppel has been applied by this court, even in the law of judgments, as to a decedent's actions to bar a subsequent claim in Thompson v. Wing. And the effect of that is that even in the law of judgment context, if there were two claims proceeding simultaneously, splitting of the claims, to Justice O'Donnell's point, you would have probably the survivorship claim tried in arbitration cited first, because arbitration is a quicker forum, and that would be collateral estoppel anyway as to the wrongful death claim. That creates the problem that I think Justice O'Donnell was alluding to in splitting these claims.
Before you sit down, one question I would like you to address, or one area, is what Justice Pfeiffer brought up, and whether you're aware of any policy decisions or statutory interpretation that allows for an intentional tort to take the action away from an arbitration arena and bar the accused intentional tortfeasor the benefit of an arbitration agreement.
No, there is no such exclusion in the Arbitration Act. There are exclusions in the Arbitration Act, but not for intentional torts. And this court has held that tort claims, as well as contract claims, if the parties agreed to arbitrate them, are subject to arbitration. And I have a lot more to say about the nature of arbitration and why that is not.
But not here.
But I will.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you very much.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.